John Lanchester has written many things, novels and obituaries and restaurant reviews, football reports, a memoir. But for over 5 years now, he has been attending to and writing about financial issues, a layman's guide to the 2008 crash called Oops, Why Everyone Owes Everyone and No One Can Pay, and a novel about money and London set in 2007-08 called Capital. It takes place in a gentrified road, Pepys Road, which is a pretty accurate microcosm of the wider city. It includes a banker and a Polish builder and a parking warden who is a Zimbabwean refugee and a Muslim family who runs the corner shop, bound together by a series of threatening letters, the crashing economy. It's been very, very well received. And John Lanchester joins me now. Hello.
Good morning, Kim.
I was thinking about that first title of your first book, The Debt to Pleasure, and wondering whether you wished you hadn't used it then, because it would have been good for a novel about a financial crash.
Yeah, my publisher at the time used to joke that I should write a sequel called The Invoice from
Yes. I know that you originally anticipated a property crash when you began writing about the economy in 2007, and then it sort of turned into something else. Your British bank, Northern Rock, collapsed, followed by Lehman Brothers the next year. And you were already writing Capital when that happened. So what, you filed it and took up the non-fiction?
Yes, I finished a draft of it. I mean, I started it in 2005, early 2006, thinking it was very likely that some form of bust was about to come. It was on the ignorant but quite well-established principle that what goes up must come down, and that the world of finance seemed to have forgotten that, and it looked very obvious that it was a bubble and bubbles always pop. So I started writing the book thinking that there was a property bubble that was going to pop, and then while I was writing it, it turned into this other thing. So I finished a draft of the novel early 2009, and I normally put a book aside for a few months to clear my head before I go back and finish it. And this time I'm going to use that time to do something constructive and, you know, write a non-fiction book about what actually happened as opposed to what I'd imagined.
And what actually happened was a great deal more complicated than a property bubble popping. And for that, many people have suggested, actually, that you deserve a knighthood for explaining it so clearly.
Well, that would assume that I would accept one. No, I mean, I got very interested in it. I was very interested in it because I wanted to understand it in the first instance. I think that one of the things that is very disconcerting for a lot of people everywhere in the world when the crash happened was that they felt they lost agency. They lost the ability to affect crucial things about their own lives. It's a recurrent theme among people who've lost their jobs everywhere is, you know, what did we do wrong? What could we have done differently? And it's a very harsh thing to accept that the answer to that is quite often nothing. You didn't do anything wrong. You couldn't have done anything differently. It's just, you know, our whole society had got too much in debt and now we have to rebalance everything. And there was this sort of systematic widespread malfeasance on the part of the financial elite and particularly the banks. And I think given that there's not much you can do and there aren't many levers that you can put your hands on and pull, understanding becomes very important. And that thing of explaining it so that you can understand it, so that at least you feel, you know, you might not have a lever readily to hand, but at least you can feel your feet are firmly planted on the ground. And that was my reason for wanting to write the book, to sort of explain it to myself. And then I hoped it would be clear to other people if I made it sufficiently clear to me.
Do you think the financial elite had a choice either, or do you think that they were equally helpless because they all had to do what they were all doing as long as one person was doing it, didn't they?
I think that lets them off a little bit too lightly. I think that the, there was systematic elements of misconduct in things like the way that mortgages were sold to people who they were, you know, they were knowingly sold to people who would have no possible chance of paying them back. And then those mortgages were bundled up into what they call securitized and sold on to other financial institutions who also didn't care that the people paying the mortgage would at some point go broke, because in turn they were then selling on the products to other people. I think there's a lot of, to say that they were all at it and therefore it's okay, passes by a lot of conduct that I think most people in their own daily lives, if they were faced with those choices at work, would feel that they were unethical or in plain English wrong. So I do think there's a lot of, yes, there's collective momentum of the culture in the financial industry, blah, blah, but there's also a lot of straightforward wrongdoing too.
Yeah, although I wasn't suggesting that because they were all at it, it makes it okay. I was simply suggesting that, you know, in the dog-eat-dog world of capitalism, if you are a banker with ethics, then you wouldn't survive. I mean, is that fair to say?
I think there are quite a few bankers with ethics. My father worked for a bank. You know, part of the reason I feel, you know, a lot of people feel put off by this stuff in advance, that they feel they almost don't have permission to understand it because it's inherently too complex. But my dad worked for a bank. I know it's not inherently too complex. And the products they sell sometimes are, you know, literally like rocket science, these derivative things. But the basic principles of what banks do and should be doing aren't outside the reach of ordinary ethics and common sense. And I think that really does apply to bankers' daily lives too. You know, they don't have to cross these ethical lines. And I think a lot of the time directions were set that were, knowingly unethical and that aren't necessarily particularly more profitable as a result. When you look at the mayhem that's happened inside the financial sector and the number of institutions that have gone broke, you know, it's not clear to me that being a good guy and playing by the rules is actually a worse strategy.
And the news keeps on rolling. You know, JP Morgan's losses look like they're twice as big as originally estimated, and that's like billions and billions and billions. And this LIBOR business with Barclays Bank, which I don't quite grasp, and I'm going to get you to try to explain it to me in a moment, seems to be spreading to the Bank of England. I'm wondering how far you think it will go.
Oh, the LIBOR thing is really, this is Act One, Scene One, I think, because I think I'm writing saying 22 banks have been named in the lawsuit that's been filed in the court in Baltimore. And LIBOR is the rate at which banks lend money to other banks. And it's an incredibly important number because lots of things are keyed to it. Lots of ordinary people's mortgages and all sorts of things in the financial industry. $375 trillion US dollars. And that's not a slip of the tongue. $375 trillion US dollars of transactions every year are keyed to LIBOR. So it's quite a strong candidate for the single most important number in the entire global financial system. And the fact that banks were, one bank has admitted to telling lies in an attempt to manipulate it. And as I say, 21 others are named in the lawsuit. And on the face of it, you have a really astonishing level of systematic corruption right at the heart of the global financial system.
As has been revealed by the contents of emails, more than anything else, really, haven't it?
Yes, promising, here's a bottle of Bollinger, you know, come around, I owe you big time, and things like, anything for you, big boy, that was one of the emails. And
it's that, shocking business, isn't it?
Oh, it's funny, but it's also grotesque.
What would your father say? Your father, as you said, was a banker in Hong Kong, but an old-style banker, you know, back in the days where bankers had a certain amount of respectability, actually. What would he say?
The thing I'd say about my dad was that he hated any kind of story in which the bad guys got away with it. He couldn't watch things like that. He found them very upsetting. And I think it follows from that, I think almost all the developments in this world of modern banking would have made him feel, I think, close to physically sick.
Mm. The banker I was thinking in your book, Capital, Roger, who is the banker that ends up at the wrong end of the bonus and has a conspicuously consuming wife, Do you feel sorry for him? Because there is a certain amount of compassion and empathy extended to him in your book, I think.
I don't feel sorry for him. I don't hate him. I thought people might hate him. I'd be quite surprised in people's responses to the book that they haven't. I think it's mainly because he's weak. You know, that's the big thing about Roger.
He's weak, but he gets it in the end.
He does get it. A more sort of obstinate or thicker-skinned man might not get it, and I think we would be less empathetic. But in a sense, that character came from, you know, I started hearing about people who live, you know, around and about the kind of place I live in, and, you know, I'd hear that in some years they'd get a bonus of £1 million, and I fell to thinking, which seemed, you know, inconceivable amount of money.
It's nuts, isn't it?
And of course it is nuts. No one doing kind of salaried employment actually should, in quotes. I used to love the Socialist Worker paper used to put the word earns in quote marks next to these things. So they earns £1 million in quotes.
So the bonus is more than the salary.
Oh, far, far.
See,
more,
I don't understand that.
Well, that's the norm in the City of London. The bonuses are 3 or 4 times normal pay. Mm. I'll tell you what, Kim. I wouldn't try to understand it because it doesn't actually make sense.
Well, that's a relief, and you've taken a huge weight off my mind. One of the things that you've said, actually, is that the profound break between the language of finance and that of common sense is what strikes you. And you're quite right. And you could drive yourself crazy if you tried to understand it, I suppose. That's the point, isn't it?
Well, I think this thing happened, you know, we mentioned my dad, and he was a banker in the day when it was actually a quite simple business and also a very honourable one. You know, we need banks to create credit and liquidity in the economy. And if you have an excess of cash, you deposit it in your bank, and then the bank looks for someone who needs cash for their business or to buy a house or whatever, and they lend them to them. And you deposit it at 3%, they lend it at 5%, and you make money forever. All you have to do is to check the quality of the people you're lending money to. You look them in the eye, you look at their business plan, and you do it on that basis. And it's a simple, honourable, ethical, vital component of a modern economy. And the thing is, the place where we've ended up with these things is this crazy casino with people simply betting. You know, if you're Goldman Sachs, I'm JP Morgan, you take out a complicated derivative package based on, you know, weighted futures of the Argentinian peso in 2016 against the yen in 2015 against the possibility of a Greek default in 2014. You can package that all together in a set of instruments designed to benefit from whichever way the currencies move, one direction or other. You take one side of it, I take the other side. One of us wins, one of us loses. It's straightforwardly betting. It's just like going down the casino, plonking the money on red and black. And the social utility of that is zero. But if it blows up on a sufficiently big scale, the taxpayers end up having to bail you out and pay for it. And this is a really, you know, this is nobody's idea of how the world is supposed to work. The phrase socialism for the rich is supposed to be a joke, and it's actually ended up the system. It's actually literally the system, socialism for the rich.
As you've said, a huge unregulated boom in which almost all the upside went directly into private hands, followed by a gigantic bust in which the losses were socialised.
Yes, and have, you know, largely bankrupted taxpayers across the developed world. And, you know, a big part of the predicament that states are in all across the world is because they've taken on the bank's balance sheets, effectively. And, you know,
so you have a certain amount of sympathy with the plight of the Spanish or the Greeks?
I do. I mean, you know, they're all a bit nuanced, those different stories. The Spanish, I mean, the irony about Spain is Spanish banks are very conservative. They didn't get involved in the casino-like activities because they were forbidden to by law. They didn't do all that derivative stuff, the JP Morgan type stuff you're talking about. They legally couldn't do that. So what they had is a garden variety property bubble, which went completely nuts. So I've sympathy up to a point. I mean, on the other hand, you know, there's an old saying in the world of money, the two things that are always untrue in the world of money, there are two sentences that are always untrue. The first one is the check is in the post, and the second one is this time is different. And, you know, and people are very prone to believing that this time it's different. And they have this crazy, crazy property bubble in Spain. And there are all sorts of complicated reasons why, you know, this time it's different because we're in the euro, interest rates are low, Spanish economy, endless potential for growth, blah, blah, blah. And actually, guess what? This time it wasn't different. It's a crazy bubble. And now they have 50% of everyone under the age of 25 unemployed. I mean, that's, you know, in a developed economy, that is a very, very hard thing. You know, nobody really knows what that, how that's going to play out. Half of all your young people out of work and no prospect of improvement.
What do you, I mean, can I get a prediction from you about what's going to happen to Europe?
My crystal ball is a bit rubbish. It keeps kind of conking out and falling over. And I'd point out that even when I started work on this book, I was wrong, you know, because I thought, I was sure there was going to be a bust, but I thought it was kind of routine London property bust. I didn't know it was going to be a global systemic crash. So, my crystal ball is a bit rubbish. I think we have many difficult years ahead, particularly in Europe, and that is likely to be a bit of a break on the global financial system, and that there's a tremendous drama playing out between, democracy at the national level, in which people don't want cuts, austerity, and all that stuff, and the sort of international demands of the markets, sort of international economic principles versus democratic principles. And I really, really don't know how that's going to play out, but I suspect it's going to be a seriously bumpy ride.
You go back to the fall of the Berlin Wall, and you suggest that because the capitalist West won, as you put it, the jet engine of capitalism was harnessed to the ox cart of social justice before, but then the jet engine was unhooked from the ox cart when the wall crumbled. Why? Why was the jet engine unhooked and allowed to roar off at its own speed?
Well, I should say, Kim, you know, this is refreshingly free of evidence, this theory. It's just, you know,
I thought evidence is always overrated.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And also you can pick and choose. I think it's just very hard to explain why we have this measurable, in the developed world, we have this measurable increase in equality, prosperity, longevity, all sorts of things, from the end of the war until about 1980. And then suddenly, once we start winning the Cold War, the financial sector just sort of takes off and those trends go into reverse. Longevity is still going up, but inequality is sharply increased. And the things that you get with inequality, which are, proven as a correlation, though not proven as a cause. But the correlation with increasing inequality is, you know, increasing levels of crime, increasing levels of mental health, really systematic marital breakdown, all sorts of systematic structural problems that you get when inequality goes up. And you have to ask why it happens at that point. And I think it's essentially because the financial sector regarded itself as having, you know, won the Cold War. And in a system where you have a doctrinaire free market capitalism regards itself as having been proven right.
So it was triumphal.
Yeah. And you know, the people in charge of the system, then, okay, this is the bit where we, you know, we claim the spoils. Because one of the things you do get, by the way, is that, you know, and one of the reasons lots of capitalists are very angry about what's happened is they regard the bankers and the financial system as having broken capitalism just by taking too much of the pie for themselves. You know, this is not capitalism functioning even on its own terms.
There's a certain amount of talk about a revival of Marx, you know, because the workers have been bailing out the rich and Marxism is seen as at least a tool to analyse the crisis. And as somebody's pointed out, the young people don't, it's not as tainted for them by Stalinism because they don't remember. What do you think? Do you think that there is some space for Marxism to make a comeback?
I think it's always been very useful as an analytic tool. There's this old French saying, qui dit historien dit Marxist, whoever says historian says Marxist, that in a sense, when you look at history, you do see patterns of contest between interest groups and classes, and you know, economic forces as perhaps the fundamental shaping force of the world. So it's a really, really handy tool looking back. I think that as a sort of prescription for the future, I think Marxism is less successful because, you know, the reality is that there is now only one economic system on the planet. It is capitalism. The point about capitalism, mind you, is it comes in lots of different flavours. That's the thing I think that is maybe insufficiently stressed. And certainly, in a funny way, the free marketers and the few remaining Marxists don't exactly collude, but they both end up making it sound as if capitalism is only one thing, whereas in fact, you know, Scandinavian welfare state capitalism is very, very different from red in tooth and claw aggressively free market system that you have in a country like America, which in turn is very different from somewhere like Singapore, which has very liberalized markets but entirely state-owned housing. So there are lots and lots of different capitalisms out there, and I think that the that in a way an area for progress is to think about what kind of mixed and complicated model we want, rather than thinking there's this sort of off-the-shelf solution called free markets, which isn't how the West became prosperous in the first place.
No. And, I mean, that's all, isn't it? Is capitalism still capitalism if it's alteration finds? People have insisted for a while that as soon as you start regulating it, it ceases to be what capitalism's strengths are. But that might have changed now, you think?
Also, it's historically a complete fib. You know, America at the point when it was massively building up its prosperity in the 19th and early 20th century was one of the most protectionist economies in the world. We prescribe complete free markets to the developing world, but no developed society became rich completely opening its markets to competition for products and labour. You know, it's a wonderful elixir we're selling, but it's not the elixir we took ourselves.
And so your prediction that banks will become heavily regulated, and this seems to be a logical thing, but I don't know whether it's going to happen. Investment banking will be separate from everyday banking, so you won't get the casino taking over. Are there serious moves in that direction, or is it just a wishful thing?
No, they're still faffing about, really.
Yeah.
I think mainly because, you know, the bankers won the peace in 2008.
Well, they won, but they are, you know, they're reviled.
Yeah, no, that's right. They made a catastrophic series of mistakes in relation to how they're perceived. And the big problem is that they are arrogant and oblivious and out of touch and entitled and full of a sense of grievance and wrongness and that they're misunderstood. And they allowed all those things to show. And so we're in a position where they have no political capital left. So the next time the financial sector implodes, which I suspect won't be all that distant, there's nothing left in the bank.
What's left to implode? I mean, what can implode now?
Oh, plenty. I mean, they're in a very frail condition, a lot of the big banks. You know, if the European states can't pay back the money they've borrowed, which they can't do unless the European economy grows, which it's not, if they can't pay back their debts, then the people who hold those debts have a really serious problem. And the people who hold those debts are overwhelmingly the world's banks, mainly the European banks, but not exclusively. And we're back to 2008, except that, you know, the scale of it, Lehman was important because it was at the centre of various transactions, but it wasn't important by terms of its size, whereas the size of this would make that whole thing look like a, you know, a theme park ride. It was quite scary, but you knew it was going to turn out all right in the end, whereas this is a different order of magnitude.
In Capital, you make it clear that there are individual human beings, they're real, and as the elephants fight it out beyond their street, they are impacted by it. Is it like your neighbourhood? I mean, I don't want to make it sound autobiographical, but is Pepys Road kind of like your neighbourhood? Suddenly, people are rich by the very fact that they live in a house in that area.
Broadly speaking, I mean, it's not drawn from life in the sense it's not a literal street, but there are streets around where I live that are like that. And the thing about the vertiginous upward rush of house prices having changed the demographics. I mean, it changes the demographics in a simple way, because all the people who move into the street then work in finance, and that's very much drawn from life. And the sense of the mix is drawn from life. That's a thing I was very interested in the novel, that just the ways London's become a kind of microcosm of things that happen all around the world, partly in a straightforward way. You know, places like Somalia gets into trouble and blows up, and suddenly there are 300,000 Somalis living in the southeast of England and London. And, you know, I'm interested in that thing of London as a microcosm of the world, and then I imagine this street as a sort of microcosm of London.
It's also, I mean, you've got various commentaries going on, a commentary on the health system, for example. There's an elderly woman who has cancer, and she has to struggle painfully through a system which is at best impersonal and at worst inefficient. Is that something that you are making a particular point about, or was it a character development rather than anything else?
I didn't think of anything in the book as being commentary, as opposed to description. It partly helped, you know, because I went off and wrote the non-fiction thing in the middle before I went back to finish novel. And insofar as there's commentary and explanation, and, you know, I'm talking directly to the reader, that's in the non-fiction. The Petunia, her experiences in the healthcare system are, you know, they're not autobiographical, but they're descriptions of things I've seen.
And there is also a sense of inequality, and there's also a sense of community being lost in the broader sense. I mean, people don't really know each other terribly well on Pepys Road until they're thrust together by circumstance. Is it nostalgia? Do you have nostalgia?
I don't think I do. I grew up a long way away from London. I moved there as an adult, so I don't have an older version of it for which I'm pining. The thing about people really don't. I mean, I don't know the New Zealand version of this, and I'm interested in everybody's version of it, because it does really seem to vary place by place, that sense of where the community exists in a geographical sense. I think most of us have, you know, if we're lucky enough to be in work, we have a work community, people have family communities, people have internet communities that matter maybe less than they think they do, but they do feel connected through those things. But geographical community, that sense of, you know, you're in it together with the people who happen to live around you, that really varies place by place. And my experience of London has been there's none of it, effectively. You just don't know your neighbours. I mean, there's almost a form of good manners in it. There's the wonderful American writer Paul Theroux, who lived in London for many years. At some point in one of his novels, he makes the throwaway remark, you know, we didn't get to know our neighbours on the sound British principle, since that there's no point, because if you do, you'll probably just hate them anyway. And so in a funny way, there's almost a kind of good manners about, you know, not knowing each other, when we live so, so close together, so higgledy-piggledy, so sort of squished into small spaces. And at the same time, there is a loss in that. There's a, you know, there's a closeness that just isn't present.
The Roger banker, the banker we were speaking of before, who in the end gets it, is married to the egregious Arabella, who is a conspicuous consumer, and never gets it. Would she not really get it?
I'm really interested by that. There's this thing that people do in books that I think they do much less often in real life. People in books and movies and telly, they're always realising things. You know,
yes.
They go along.
And it's the arc,
and they
isn't
realize,
it?
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I think that it's a very helpful convention. I've used it myself more than once in writing. But I think in real life, people aren't that good at realising things. And certainly I think about myself, I'm not sure I've ever realised anything in quite that way. You know, when you sort of like stand at the crossroads and look at the thing, I realise this must be my direction. You know, sometimes you look back over your shoulder and it becomes apparent that you've taken a fork in the road.
But you never go, oh my God, my entire life has been a terrible mistake.
Well, or you know, I was really right to do that. You know, they can be positive revelations too. Oh. I just, you know, I think most of us sort of bumble through the days. And I think we are very, very, very good at being oblivious. I'm very interested in obliviousness. It was one of the themes in the book. It's one of the things I was interested in writing about the world of money. And I wanted to have a character in it who is a kind of fixed point, who has all these things happen that should cause her to realise, But actually, she just doesn't. The thing that's 2 inches in front of her nose, she just doesn't see. And I'm afraid, that we often do that. It's one of those things that's very easy to diagnose in other people, and it's really, really annoying in other people, especially close friends and family. But we never quite catch ourselves doing.
So we have oblivious and we have helpless. In terms of you, as a way to help us understand how one can get through these times, what have you done? Have you changed the way you are? Have you done something to make you feel as if you're more in control?
Well, I've spent now a total of about 6 years writing about it. And since that's my day job, it's very much at the kind of core of my being, the engagement with this and the attempt to understand it and to sort of work through it. And
that's nice for you. for the rest of us poor sods, is there any way that we can protect ourselves from the stampeding elephants?
I think understanding, I can only speak from first hand. I think sense of understanding is really important. I think it feeds through into the debate, because one of the reasons the financial industry got to write its own rules was because people didn't know what they were talking about. And you could be a perfectly functioning, literate, intelligent adult. Those are actually four different things, but if you could be all those things at once and not have a clue about anything to do with the world of money and finance, and it was perfectly all right not to. It's, socially and practically acceptable, not to know what a bond was. And I think that thing of understanding is actually, as well as being psychologically important, it's also really democratically important, because our democracy is much thinner if we don't know what we're doing when we think about these things, and when governments do things and we actually have no idea what it is they're doing, that's actually a fundamental failure of the democratic process.
It's all right to know what's going wrong, but it's quite another thing to be able to stop it or change it or affect it. And it seems so far a choice between helplessness and anger.
Well, I don't quite think that. I mean, I think the understanding is crucial, because I think, you can have a version of off-the-shelf anger, which doesn't necessarily help, that... I would stress that thing about, thinking it through as being important, because then you have solutions which could actually help. I think that, when elections come up, it's very important for us to put pressure on our democratic leaders to do the things that we all think they need to do in terms of reining the financial sector in and returning it to a utility. It's actually quite a simple thing that banking should do. We need it to take those deposits and then lend money. It's not rocket science, it's not very sexy. It's certainly not what they do now. But the core of what we need banking to be is actually very clear cut. And, insofar as we have any levers in relation to anything, I think we all have levers we can pull in terms of, telling our politicians what we want for them, which is to make it simpler, fairer, clearer and more useful.
Have to get some money back into the system before anything else happens though, don't we?
Well, but it's our money anyway. It's all it's taxpayers' money being recycled into the financial institutions, and it's a question of what, that is going to happen because they're so near the edge. The question is more what it's done once the capital is injected. And certainly what we have here in the UK is we've had an immense programme of effectively printing electronic money, which actually in fact is not that different from having elves make it in a cave. And when people ask me to explain quantitative easing, it's actually more useful to think of it as magic money. Yeah. Elves.
yes, that's right. Are you going to continue to focus on financial things for the foreseeable future?
No, I don't think so. I mean, what I do now is, because I spent these years working on it, I'm not planning to write another book about it, but what I do is, no doubt you'll tell me this is pompous and self-important, but I see
it seems unlikely.
As a sort of democratic, obligation to talk across that gap. There is this thing, there are people who speak money and they speak this sort of private language and they have effectively been allowed to write their own rules. And because I've sort of swatted up on it and now feel like I partly can speak money myself, the way I do it is whenever I'm asked to say something about it and feel I have something to say, I chip in. But I can't face writing another book about it because it's so... because it's not my, you know, it's not that I'm inherently consumed by fascination with it. It's just been the story that's been happening now. But I'd very happily write an 800-page novel about bunny rabbits going on a voyage of internal discovery.
Ah, I think, yes, maybe that's been done.
Well, the Watership Down is a long time ago and everyone's amnesiac, you know, so they'd forget.
That's true. Marx plus Watership Down.
Or about
Down.
Spanking, that's the other thing, you know. Spanking bunny rat. Well, spanking is the other thing that's massive. Do you have you not got this in New Zealand
yes,
yet?
Yes, yes, we banned spanking.
Have you? Oh, yep. Thank God.
Well, yes, you may well say that. Others dispute it. Others, well, of course, argue that the Bible says spare the rod and spoil the child, etc.
No, I was meaning the spanking in the 50 Shades of Grey sense.
Oh, what?
That's spanking.
That's spanking.
Not spare the rod, spoil the child. Oh. The, you know, cruelly handsome
no.
billionaire and the...
Yes, yes. No, as long as people are grown up, they can spank each other all they like, it seems. I know. 50 Shades of Grey. Have you read them?
No. I looked at the free online, you know, because it started life as this, what they call slash fiction, this pornographic rewriting of the Twilight books. When the characters had the same name as the characters in the Twilight books, and I tried to read it, but I could actually feel my eyeball starting to bleed, and so I stopped.
I had the same experience. I was in an airport bookshop, and I thought, oh, let's have a look, and then I thought, why? Why is this happening?
It's
I don't know. Why is it happening?
I don't know, but it's really, really interesting as a thing where people, you know, it is suddenly... In the last 5 minutes, become completely socially acceptable to be reading pornography in public. You know, 10 minutes ago you couldn't do that, and now you know every time you're in a tube compartment or on a bus, there are five people there reading porn. You know, and that's one of the things that's really amazing about it—the speed with which that social norm has been completely rewritten.
Yes, I was going to ask you whether you thought that Capital was not only a post-crash novel, but also a post-9/11 novel, but spankings just throw me completely off the rails.
Well, spanking is more of the moment, that's for sure.
Yes, it certainly is. And I think that you could find an avenue for your talents in that zone.
Well, you're very, very, very sweet to say so, I think.
No, I think you should give up being pompous and self-important, John. And take up spanking.
Well, like that nice Mr. Thingy in the book.
Yeah, that nice Mr. Thingy in the book. Somebody has emailed, and they're obviously a huge fan of yours, and they adored your memoir, Family Romance, which described your extraordinary mother, actually, who entered a convent twice and took years off her life in order to persuade her husband to be that she was still a childbearing age, I mean, to put it crudely. And it worked, because thus here you were, come to pass. But this fan wanted to know about your experiences at Gresham's School in Holt in Norfolk.
Wanted to know what about them?
Well, he said he taught there in the 80s and found it anarchic.
Oh, really? Well, anarchic wouldn't necessarily be the worst word for it. It was fairly wild. My children think I sometimes... entertain them with stories of things that used to go on there in the 70s, and they recoil in amazement. And
what are we talking about? Drugs, sex, spanking, what?
All the above. And actually, funnily enough, the corporal punishment aspect, which was real, no joke, is one of the things that children today find completely in. You know, they actually don't believe that people would be regularly hit with a stick.
No, it is an odd thing, isn't it?
Astonishing thing.
Yeah.
It was pretty wild. I liked it because I was, an only child from a quite sheltered background. I grew up in Hong Kong, and being in a sort of very rough and ready, very mixed, very outdoorsy, very sporty, very strong rugby school, all those things had a strong socialising effect.
I see. Not a traumatising effect.
Not for me, no.
The fan, if you'll excuse him for asking, also says, do you still have the panic attacks? Because he had them too, and he took the beta blockers, and they did help, but he's not cured.
No, I don't actually. And one of my reasons in writing that book was to put certain things in the past. A funny thing happens when you write about something. It has a sort of...
Can we use that word cathartic?
I see it as more like a form of magic, actually, that things do get put into the past tense. I think that's the way I'd put it. And you have to be careful about that, because you can use up good things as well. But one of my motives in writing that book was to put that in the, you know, put it behind me. And to a large extent it did. Funnily enough, a thing that was very important, I thought it would be the writing of the book which sort of worked things through and had that sort of magic spell effect. But it was actually, another thing was fully as important. The publishing of it was very important, had a very strong effect.
You mean having other people read it?
And going through, reading from it in public and sort of talking it out in public and sort of, I don't know, sort of standing up and standing behind it. And those two things taken together did have... something close to a magical effect.
How interesting. A personal question for Keith in Auckland, who instructs me to ask you, should they sell up their house in leafy Auckland and get rid of their mortgage and go gypsy in Spain? This is a serious question. He wants advice.
I can't possibly advise on that. Their house sounds quite nice, though.
House sounds nice, but also going gypsy in Spain sounds quite nice, depending on where you chose to do it, doesn't it?
It does sound quite nice, but I tell you what my Spanish friends would say, is that there's something really unfunny and dark about Spain at the moment.
Yes.
You know, it's not in a happy place. And that thing about, I know I'm repeating myself, but, 50% youth unemployment. And that's excluding people who are voluntarily, who living at home and, for other reasons or taking university degrees or whatever, 50% youth unemployment. That's an unprecedented thing.
In a
country, I mean, this is the 12th richest country in the world.
You're quite right. Get a grip, Keith. Stay in your leafy Auckland suburb and stop these ridiculous dreams of going gypsy in Spain. If I could paraphrase you, John, thank you for your advice. John Lanchester, whose latest book is a novel. It's called Capital, and it is about London, and it is about money. And it's a good read.